Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday morning. Since the year 2006, millions of honeybees have been dying in a phenomena known as colony collapse disorder. There was a comprehensive federal study on this issue published in May, and the study found there was no single cause of honeybee deaths. Devastation of the American honeybee colonies, they say, a result of a complex stew of factors: pesticides, parasites, poor nutrition, and a lack of genetic diversity. This hour of the program, we will talk about this issue, which certainly is a very important one, as honeybees are pollinators of a significant number of foods that we use every single day. Our guest this hour is Professor May Barenbaum, a professor and head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She's interested in the chemical interactions between herbivorous insects and their host plants, and the implications of such interactions on the organization of natural communities and the evolution of species. We'll be welcoming your phone calls. We always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor May Barenbaum, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I just mentioned how significant this problem is. Would you add to that, please? This is a huge number of honeybees that have been dying, and it's not just in America. It's in Europe. It's all over the world, I imagine.
It is. I mean, there are a few little bright spots, but in general, the picture is pretty grim, and it's of significant concern globally, not because people have a soft spot in the heart for little furry bees, but because the honeybee is the world's premier managed pollinator. It's semi-domesticated. It lives in conveniently in boxes that can be transported to and delivered to crops that are in need of pollination over a short time period. And it's also a social species that has colonies with tens of thousands of workers, so it can pollinate large monoculture crops. And it's also amazingly broad in its diet, so as opposed to some of the solitary bees that only take nectar and pollen from a small number of species. So there's no replacing the honeybee for managed pollination, and globally it contributes about $200 billion to economies in terms of its agricultural pollination services.
This study that was just published in May said there wasn't a single cause. They were looking at all kinds of factors: pesticides, parasites, poor nutrition, a lack of genetic diversity. Did you imagine that the study would be that broad and would point to that many factors?
Well, back in the early 2007, when this phenomenon of sudden disappearance first appeared, there was a desperate hope that there would be one single causative factor that could be isolated and dealt with. And study after study has failed to find that one single factor. So it's a complicated situation, and that means there's not an easy solution.
Mm-hmm. And yet the Europeans have taken steps toward banning a certain class of pesticides. Why did they go that direction and we did not?
Well, it's worth pointing out that the European move was not unanimously supported. It was a real squeaker of a vote
really,
in terms of the ban. And as well, the situation may be different in Europe. Beekeeping is really a different enterprise here in the U.S. It's really, in many ways, unique in the U.S. and in how it's been industrialized, for want of a better word. So I can't really speak authoritatively for the European situation, but here, and I've actually taken some flack for this position, despite the fact that I'm an ecologist by training. I'm sort of a tree hugger since way back.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and I also work on the my scientific interest is in how insects metabolize toxins, natural or synthetic. And the there is just not compelling evidence that banning three of this particular class of chemicals, these neonicotinoids, would have a dramatic impact, much less provide a solution. And that's in part because American farmers would not stop using pesticides. And, before any ban can be enacted, it's important to determine what would replace those pesticides. And the alternatives are not very pretty either.
Mm-hmm. And this was supposed to be a somewhat, if you can say this, more environmentally friendly pesticide, not as toxic as others?
It's how technology or good intentions have an annoying habit of turning around and kind of surprising you with how things turn out. Because one of the big problems with the use of neonicotinoids, this new class of pesticides, is that they are used to treat seeds, particularly corn, and they then become incorporated into all parts of the plant. So this so-called systemic use of pesticides was touted initially as environmentally compatible and sustainable because the alternative is broadcast application of pesticides. It's not highly targeted. It's likely to contaminate non-target areas and also to kill non-target species. As it turns out, the use of systemic pesticides has not been quite as laser-like in its targeting as people had hoped. When systemic use was being promoted, there wasn't much thought given to how incorporation of these pesticides in nectar and pollen might affect insects.
Mm-hmm. So given the
beneficial insects, sorry?
Given the broad nature of this problem, is there one area does all of your research indicate that there's one area that really needs more attention than another?
If there is a good thing that to have emerged from colony collapse disorder, it's that it has made us far less complacent about the availability of pollination services. For decades, the honeybee was taken for granted. And its contributions, the value of its contributions as a pollinator, were really not appreciated. Pollination fees. Now there are so few native pollinators, and bees are in such high demand that rental fees for hives, growers have to actually arrange for beekeepers to equip their to bring hives to their orchards or ranches or farms to provide pollination services. So rental fees have increased by an order of magnitude over the last 30 years. And it's hard to meet the demand. The beekeepers can't sustain these losses and at the same time provide sufficient pollination services with their honeybees. It's a very unstable situation for American agriculture.
Obviously, the result of all this would be food prices would be going up as well, right?
Absolutely. And even to some extent, availability. Probably the crunch point in terms of American agriculture is the almond industry, which is expanding by leaps and bounds. When this began, this whole colony collapse disorder, bee decline phenomenon, there were about 600,000 acres planted in almonds in 2007. They're now up to over 800,000. And it's now a $3.5 billion crop. And the point is, no almonds are produced without honeybee visitation. The entire crop,
really?
All 800,000 acres, depend on honeybees. Half of America's 2.5 million colonies get trucked to California during a two-week period in February to provide those pollination services. So that's that's a huge demand on our apiculture industry. And, there have been major near disasters because it has not been abundantly clear that those pollination services could be delivered.
When you say that we were taking honeybees for granted for a long time, what kind of attention should we have been paying to them that we weren't?
Well, a crisis that occurred in the apiculture industry and consequently honeybees that escape from from domestication and become feral or established in the wild. No, there are no native Apis species. So all honeybees in North America are descendants of imports from elsewhere. The honeybee itself is native to Africa and Asia, the Old World. So in mid-1980s, a parasitic mite called Varroa destructor, was accidentally introduced into the U.S.
Oh.
This is a mite that normally attacks another species of Apis, another honeybee called the eastern honeybee, Apis serrana. Ours is the western honeybee. So Apis serrana and this mite have sort of coexisted for a long time. Apis mellifera was defenseless against this mite.
Mm.
The mite sucks the hemolymph, the blood of the honeybee, particularly when it's pupating in that very vulnerable metamorphic stage where it's immobilized and sealed inside a cell and is, you know, all its tissues are being rearranged to construct a new adult bee. And they're helpless. And this introduction of the mite has caused massive losses and has led to control techniques used by beekeepers that involve applying chemicals directly inside the hive.
Hmm.
So they're desperate. Two pesticides, one called Coumaphos, one called Talfluvalinate, that had not been developed initially to treat varroa mites, were found to be moderately less toxic to honeybees than to the mite, and beekeepers began to use them. Mites developed resistance. Other chemicals were introduced. The point of this is these chemicals were introduced into the beehive, into the home of the bee. There's no escape. It's, you know, it's in their house,
yes,
basically. And no one knew a thing about how honeybees metabolize these chemicals.
Oh.
So it was, you know, it was the industry was desperate. People were desperate. Chemicals were the fallback. And it's not clear that honeybees are as equipped, well equipped to deal with toxic chemicals as other insects. Among other things, when the honeybee genome was sequenced in 2006, one of the big surprises of the genome project was that honeybees have fewer genes that code for detoxification enzymes than other insect genomes.
Hmm.
And when you think about their evolutionary history, they are pollinators. They are mutualists. They feed on nectar and pollen, which tend to be relatively innocuous in terms of their chemical content, as opposed to leaves, which plants pack full of chemicals to deter herbivores.
Oh, that's interesting. What about the issue of a lack of genetic diversity?
That's another enormous issue. Again, we in the U.S. like to streamline and industrialize, and in around the mid-1930s, artificial insemination techniques became widely available so that people developed the technology to inseminate queens, and then began sort of a queen rearing industry began. So we humans took over the job of you know, picking mates and determining who gets mated to whom, and the honeybee natural mating in the honeybee was a mystery for centuries. Basically, the queen flies out of the hive, the virgin queen flies out and attracts numerous males, drones, and mates with up to 24 of them at a time. And that's it. She'll never mate again. She lives for 3 or 4 years, and she'll use that stored sperm for the rest of her life.
Hmm.
Now, artificially inseminated bees, queens tend not to be mated with sperm or semen from 24 bees. So
People
were not aware of the value of that genetic diversity in terms of bee health. In fact, just a paper just came out, I think today or yesterday, in a journal called Naturwissenschaften, that in which it was artificially inseminated queens were compared, their colonies were compared relative to the number of drones used to supply semen. And those with multiple drone semen had a substantially higher survival rate than those that were inseminated with fewer drones. So it's clear, again, that the honeybee has adapted to multiple matings in order to provide genetic diversity for dealing with all kinds of stresses. So this queen industry and our practice of controlling bee reproduction may have inadvertently, again, a technological, you know, unforeseen consequence,
yes,
in eroding the quality of the genetic quality of the hive.
So have we stopped doing that?
No. Among other things, it's a convenience. I mean, you can order a drone. I mean, you can order a queen, a fertilized queen, and she comes in the mail, and you can install the queen. You don't have to worry about, you can even sort of custom order particular attributes. So it's a convenience thing. You know exactly when the colonies will be requeened, and the problem in the industry is that there are not that many queen breeders, so there's kind of a bottleneck there. That said, Washington State University has just announced a project that's been in the works for many years. There's a professor there, bee expert Steve Shepard, who has traveled around the world collecting bee semen and has created a bee sperm bank, essentially, that has genetic representation from about over 20 different races of honeybees around the world. Most of our apiculture depends on a single race, Apis mellifera ligustica. So we're only tapping into a tiny sliver of the entire genetic diversity that is Apis mellifera. And the sperm bank may help deal with this problem.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll do it in a moment. Professor Mae Barenbaum is our guest, an entomologist at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We're looking at this very disturbing problem that, as you can hear in the last 20 minutes or so, is very, very complicated. Millions of bees dying in colony collapse disorders. There have been studies of what's causing this, and it appears to be all kinds of factors, pesticides and lack of genetic diversity, parasites, poor nutrition, the list goes on. It's a serious problem. It affects so many other foods that we eat. How can we change this? Are we at a point where we're at the brink here of a complete collapse, and what in the world could keep that from happening? We welcome your phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always leave messages for us on the Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Wednesday, Jonathan Alter will join us. Jonathan is a fine political analyst. He's written a couple books now about President Obama. The latest is The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. It's a wide-ranging look at the backstory of a number of issues. He looks at healthcare reform and says, I think this is interesting, had the Democrats been better able to sell health care reform, they might not have lost the House in 2010. He examines Fox News. He looks at why Republicans seem to be better in day-to-day communication. He looks at what makes the president tick, why he operates above the fray frequently, and how that may not serve him well entirely. He looks at the rise of the Tea Party movement. It's a very substantive book, and Jonathan is a good thinker. He'll be with us hour two of our show. Looking forward to that. We're talking about honeybees and the collapse of colonies this hour. Professor Mae Barenbaum is with us, and we go to phone calls now. Greg is our first caller in Milwaukee. Hello, Greg.
Hello. I would just like to bring something up. It's not just honeybees. I used to collect butterflies, and I could walk across the street and I could see 30 species. I could see hair streaks and skippers, and you name it, it was out there. I haven't seen a red spotted purple in a couple of years. It's not just honeybees. It's 6,800 liters of oxygen per gallon of gasoline when we burn our cars. A jet sucks up 8 million liters out of our atmosphere in a flight. We can't continue this. It's just stupidity. It's we're such an ignorant species. We're not sentient. We don't think of tomorrow. And that's really all I have to say. That you're not going to cure the honeybees. They're going to all die off if we keep on driving cars and burning coal and using up oxygen at such a rate and producing something like carbon dioxide, what, a 394 kilojoule per mole of energy. You're not going to break it. Nothing in nature breaks CO2. It washes out into our oceans, and it kills our plankton and our phytoplankton, which make most of our oxygen. So we are going to go extinct if we continue to do this, but we're too stupid to seek. That's all I really have.
Professor.
Well, let me just say you're absolutely right. The honeybee is a managed pollinator, but in 2006, the National Research Council released the outcome of a study, an 18-month study on the status of pollinators in North America. There is clear evidence for decline in the honeybee managed populations, but as well spotty evidence for documented declines in a number of other pollinators. And the reason that evidence was spotty is that nobody has been monitoring. We have been blissfully unaware of the fact that native pollinators are also in decline. Two species of bumblebees may in fact be already be extinct, and if not extinct, they're certainly locally extirpated. There are clear documented records of extinctions of subspecies or local populations of butterflies in California and elsewhere. So it's absolutely the case that honeybees are not the only pollinators at risk here. And why that's particularly important is that something on the order of 70%+ of flowering plants in terrestrial ecosystems depend on animal pollinators. So and of course, most ecological communities are structured by plants. So it's not just farmers. It's not just us as consumers. It's us as occupants of planet Earth that are at risk if the pollinators go.
So do we need to look at how much we drive and how much we fly and how much CO2 is emitted?
Well, I hate to sound, what's the word?
Alarmist?
Driving is one of many, many. The use of the release of carbon dioxide is an enormous problem. Consumption of fossil fuels, enormous problem. But there may be other things that work faster to cause problems. So I think the reader does have, I mean, the caller does have a valid point that we are kind of oblivious to the consequences of many of our activities. And awareness raising could go a long way into at least prolonging our presence here on the planet. Mm. I'm not quite as pessimistic as he is about the fate of the species.
Thanks, Greg, for the call. Flattery is next in Mary Ball. Hi, Flattery.
Good morning to you. I raise bees and I also farm, and I've observed over the past 10 years or so that I've been raising bees several things, and I'd like to hear your comments on them. One is that, like last year, I had to lock my bees up 3 or 4 days a week between mid-May and late June because of the amount of insecticides that mm-hmm. are being used. They're just tremendous. And, with spider mites and aphids attacking in infestations in alfalfa fields and soybean fields. Farmers are using them at the drop of a hat anymore. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, they aren't informing the apiarists that they're using them, so our bees are out working these fields, and they're actually dying because their insecticides are being sprayed. That's the first point. Second point is, I'd like to hear your comments on this issue of the neonicotinoids from, I guess, they're a Syngenta product in GMO corn. I don't think they're in beans yet, but they're in the corn. And that's all. I'd like to hear your comments, please.
Well, they're kind of two sides of the same coin. That in fact, you mentioned mid-May to June. Well, this is, at least here in central Illinois, is corn planting time. And there is incontrovertible evidence that bee kills can result from corn planter dust escape. One of the really unhealthy trends in U.S. agriculture is the use of these systemic pesticides. They are applied to seeds. They're seed coats, seed coatings, or seed dressings. Well, it turns out they're supposed to stick to the seed, and they don't always. And in the resulting dust, you're absolutely right, when bees come in contact with the material, it kills them. These neonicotinoids are designed to kill insects, and they are highly toxic to bees. So at least during corn planting, that is a clear route by which bees can be killed. This use of systemics kind of goes against 50 years of hard-won understanding of how pesticides should be used in a sustainable way. The lessons of integrated pest management, the major lesson is don't treat a problem that isn't there. that's how you develop resistance. In fact, that's well accepted now in medicine. You don't treat virus infections with antibiotics because then you'll end up selecting for resistance in the bacteria. Well, it's very easy to use systemics if you're a grower because you don't have to worry whether the insects are there or not. You've bought this insurance, but it's not insurance. It's a path toward resistance, and it's not a really sustainable strategy. But it's now the vast majority of seeds that are available are treated with seed coats, and not just insecticides, but fungicides, which also are toxic to bees. So that the neonics present the biggest challenge at planting time. That said, they are by far and away not the only insecticides, not the only pesticides that bees encounter. In 2010, a study was done by investigators at Penn State to monitor chemical residues in bees and in hive products, including wax and bee bread and other materials. And over 121 pesticides and their metabolites were found in this study, and with an average of 6 pesticide detections per sample. These pesticides included herbicides, fungicides, every class of insecticides, from the chlorinated hydrocarbons to pyrethroids to insect growth regulators. So honeybees tend to bring in these pesticides because, as you know, they collect pollen. They're furry. Their hairs are designed to pick up particulates. And one of my colleagues calls them flying dust mops. They fly through agricultural fields, and they bring home everything they've encountered. And it's now, again, clear these pesticide contaminants inside the hive have adverse effects, not surprisingly, on the honeybees.
Mm. Flattery.
So we do have problems with the way pesticides are used.
What's happened to your colonies, Flattery? Have you noticed a huge decline or not?
Well, 3 and 4 years ago, I did have colony collapse disorder. I did not see it last year. I'd like to respond on this neonicotinoids, though.
Mm-hmm.
The Syngenta product, their Gaucho and Cruiser, mm-hmm. I think, are the two seed applicants. And mind you, you know, I'm planting GMO as well. But they're used on less than 10% of the products. So that can't be, you talk about the dust in the corn planters. I recognize that that's there, but the Syngenta product with the neonicotinoids are less than 10%. So that can't be totally the reason, but it's obviously
affecting
the colony.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with you. And then I said earlier, I've taken some heat from saying that it's not a magic bullet. Banning neonics will not solve the problems. They won't solve the problems of disease transmission. They will not solve the problems presented by fungicide treatments, by dozens of other pesticides that the bees encounter.
Thank you, Flattery, very much for your call. Let's go to Renee Renee. Hi, Renee.
Yeah, hi. I am interested in finding out on a number of decades ago, they were doing research with the Africanized bees and combining them in South America with some of their bee populations to strengthen the bees. Is there any thought of doing genetic research as far as combining other bee species to create a stronger bee?
Well, actually, it's not a different species. It's a different race or population. And that it's exactly 1957, Warwick Kerr, a Brazilian bee geneticist, brought over an African race of bee, Apis mellifera scutellata, because the European species that was being used for apiculture in Brazil did not deal with tropical weather very well. And so we now have this Italian bee, it's called Apis mellifera lagusica, which is the one most beekeepers are keeping. And there are over 20 different subspecies or races of honeybees. So, yes, there's a great deal of interest in examining the attributes of Apis mellifera as a species worldwide and using the genetic attributes of different subspecies in order to improve the honeybee that's used for apiculture. And that's the idea behind this bee sperm bank or semen bank at Washington State University.
Thanks, Renee, very much for the call. John in Mineral Point, hi.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for taking my call. No, I just want to chime in on the subject here. I'm an organic orchardist. We raise apples organically in the Mineral Point area. I also keep bees just for fun. We certainly don't depend upon my honeybees to pollinate our orchard. We depend upon native pollinators. We're in two studies of native pollinators, one at the University here in Wisconsin, the other by the Xerces Society, and our native pollinators increased year to year as we, continue our organic production practices out there. The point I want to make is already been made in many ways, but it's ironic to me that that the one kind of natural mechanism that industrial agriculture depends upon in some cases, i.e., honeybees to pollinate crops like the one that's been mentioned, the almond crop. It's just ironic to me that commercial agriculture has gone so far to eliminate insects just indiscriminately. I mean, the almond industry being the top of the list. You know, they kill every insect in the area, and then they have to import insects to gain their pollination. I mean, the problem here is that obviously industrial agriculture just needs to take a completely different look at nature and what goes on there. I understand that everybody can't raise their crops organically, and but certainly a movement a little bit in that direction wouldn't be bad. And killing every insect that flies in a large area just isn't the way to go. And that light bulb just needs to come on for industrial agriculture.
Professor Berenbaum.
Well said. And there are that's an entirely different phone call and discussion as to whether organic production can meet, the needs of sort of to feed the world. But I will speak up on behalf of diversifying the American agricultural landscape. That's a source of many of our problems, is that there is such a homogenization of the landscape that there is no room for any of these pollinators, particularly with the rising prices for corn as a source for biofuel. A lot of land that was set aside for conservation reserve is now being taken out of conservation reserve. We've lost, since 2007, there were 36 million acres in conservation reserve. We're down now to 27 million because of, it's just commercially, economically, there's no incentive. And as a consequence, there is, those are reserves not only, for honeybees to feed on, but also for native pollinators. So the homogenization of American agriculture has created all kinds of problems that would be ameliorated, at least in part, by a diversification of practices, like more organic growing.
One of the themes that seems to be appearing from this conversation is you talk about this hard-won information. We're seeing really dramatic things happen with honeybees that is affecting so many other foods and will have huge ramifications. I'm just wondering, when do we get the point? When do we do something that we know is the right thing to do?
Well, I'm really glad you called during National Pollinator Week. It is National Pollinator Week. This was enacted in June 2007, amazingly, by bipartisan vote. In those days, you could actually get people to sign on to issues. The whole point of this is to raise awareness about the importance of pollination. The U.S. Farm Bill is being debated right now, and it was not until 2008 that pollination was mentioned in any U.S. Farm Bill. And the irony is, of course, that over 90 American crops and over $18 billion worth of agriculture depend on pollination. So it's a slow process of awareness raising and embracing alternatives. I just hope it's not too slow.
Mm. I know you were just in Washington for a Hill Lunch and Learn session. You spoke with people in Congress. You met aides, staffers to talk mm-hmm. about some of these issues. Were they receptive? Did they know what was going on?
It's interesting. I was So I gave a lunch and learn lecture at noon, and the room was full. It was standing room only.
Really?
And earlier in the day, the Pollinator Partnership had arranged for this this lecture, and it was sponsored by Crop Life America. And while I was there, a call had gone out for anyone interested from the Senate side or the House side to meet and talk and ask questions, just for sort of a Q&A, and it could have been nobody, but in fact people came. So I was really delighted that there was interest. I just hope there can be consensus as well.
Mm-hmm. I know that you also met with a number of corporations that produce some of these pesticides, neonicotinoids, particularly. Mm-hmm. What did you talk to? What did you talk about with them?
Well, they're also wanted to know what could be done. You're right. At the Crop Life America session, Syngenta, Bayer, and Monsanto were all represented. Those on the, you know, in the environmental community tend to view these companies as the axes of evil.
Mm-hmm.
But they were there to find out what kind of research could be done. And I'm hoping for public-private partnerships, at least in part, to increase public confidence in the outcome of those studies, because industry-funded studies, and this is the point I made, that are not in the peer-reviewed literature are rightfully regarded with some suspicion. So there's been much more success with public-private partnerships, and in fact, there is an ongoing effort now to examine crop dust exposures, insecticide exposures to honeybees, and it is the result of a consortium not only of typical federal funding agencies, the beekeeping industry is contributing, pesticide manufacturing companies are contributing, and even the crop dusting machine manufacturers are contributing to this study. So that's really what we need, is people working together. It's, if you want to take a metaphor from the honeybees, I mean, they have really captured the concept of collective effort. So maybe that's a lesson we should learn from them.
More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We're looking at honeybee producers over the winter suffering over 30% losses of their hives, the whole issue of honeybee collapse, why it's happening, who's studying it, what are the recommendations for changing this. It has it's a number of issues are related to this that are of great concern, including collapse of some kinds of crops because they depend on honeybees, like almonds. Well, our guest is Professor Mae Barenbaum. She's an entomologist at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and recently was in Washington to talk about all these issues with people in Congress and also with people in corporations that produce some of the pesticides. So that's what we're talking about this hour. What have we learned about this? We've learned it's complicated. 800-486-8655, the number. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jonathan Alter, the second hour of our program. Jonathan has written one book about President Obama. This is the second, titled The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. Let's go to a couple emails that have come in and get your response to those. Here's a listener who says that he drives from Janesville to Madison just about every day and sees most landowners mowing the space between the fields and the roads as if they were golf courses. Wouldn't these little rivers of land be better left to grow native plants where they could have a refuge and pathway to other natural areas? How can the owners be educated that it's in their best interest to not mow these areas?
I wish that question or emailer had been in Washington on Monday. There was an effort to incorporate into the Farm Bill language about highway rights of way.
Oh.
Federal highway rights of way. 11 million acres are, as the questioner pointed out, kind of needlessly mowed and maintained like golf courses, which are essentially biological deserts. This is land that could provide alternative forage, high quality pollen and nectar, not to mention maintain biological diversity across the landscape. So it's not just farmers, but the highway departments and the general public have this notion that a manicured lawn that is homogeneously grass somehow is aesthetically pleasing. Through the eyes of an ecologist, it's a biological disaster zone.
Hmm.
So the questioner is absolutely correct that we are missing many, many opportunities to provide floral diversity that could maintain pollinator diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And not at cost saving. It doesn't even cost, because think of what all that mowing does. That costs. There's labor costs. There are environmental costs in terms of gas emissions and gas consumption. And what's the end result? So we really are missing opportunities. I like to say, when people ask me, what can I do to help honeybees? One is just have a little more tolerance for weeds, because what you see as a weed, a bee can see as a banquet.
Let's go to Heather in Monona, who has a question along those lines. Hi, Heather.
Hi. Yes, that's the point I was going to bring up. I have more dandelions in my front lawn than grass.
Yay.
I call it my bee diner. and I have rain gardens and other beds with natives, and I don't use any chemicals. So those are all good things, I know, but what more can other homeowners who live in an urban area do about this?
Actually, urban beekeeping is on an astronomical increase. There are a lot of local towns and cities have revisited their livestock ordinances and are making exceptions for beekeeping. And now with sort of the green roof movement, a lot of cities now have beehives. Chicago, for example, the Palmer House has beehives on its roof.
Really?
The Fairmont Hotel in Washington, D.C. has beehives, and they use the honey in their restaurants.
Huh.
There's some great honey that comes from Millennium Park. It's on the top of the Chicago City Building, because Millennium Park is an explosion of floral diversity. And the honey, as a matter of, as a consequence, is really quite nice. Paris, they've been doing this for years. So one is to be more tolerant of beekeeping around people. It's really entirely manageable. People have a sort of disproportionate fear of being stung, some people ought to. They're hypersensitive and could lead to anaphylactic shock. But the vast majority of people can cohabit with bees with no trouble. So one thing is change the laws if beekeeping is being discouraged. Talk to your neighbors about their lawns and their attitudes toward dandelions. And also buy local honey. If you buy local honey, you are supporting a beekeeper, and you are thereby supporting bees.
Hmm. Is that helpful, Heather?
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Jim in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Hello?
Yes, you're welcome.
Hi. Oh, okay. Basically, I read recently that there was some studies being done on what was affecting the pollinating insects, bees, and other things as well. And I'm not sure the company name that was doing it. I can't remember. But I do recall that Monsanto had purchased this company when it started to determine that it was possible that their genetically modified corn and such wasn't being pollinated properly by these bugs, the insects and such. And Monsanto had purchased the company that was doing the study and changed or altered the results of their study. Is this true? Did you hear anything about this?
I think what you might be talking about is Biologics. And that's Biologics is an Israeli company that is actually conducting research to protect bees from viruses by using molecular techniques, specifically RNAi, which is kind of like a gene knockout technology. So they're not actually targeting the genome of the honeybee, but they're targeting the genomes of the viruses. We have, just like with human disease, we have very, very few tools to use against viral diseases, and honeybees happen to have upwards of a dozen different viruses that, by the way, are carried by the varroa mite. So Biologics was an independent company that was, in fact, acquired by Monsanto. But one of my colleagues here, Gene Robinson, sits on the advisory board, and he has his perception is that Monsanto is interested in using or developing this technology to help bee health rather than to suppress it. So I don't know if there's another example of a Monsanto acquisition, but this particular acquisition, which was in 2011, was aimed at developing products to enhance bee health by protecting them from viral diseases.
Thanks, Jim, very much for the call. Without being too alarmist, but maybe we need to be, what happens, Professor Barenbaum, if we continue to see these colonies collapse? What happens to other crops? What happens?
You know, so I've been asked, is the honeybee going to go extinct? And
right.
Are we all going to starve? And we're not going to starve. The vast majority of calories that are consumed by humans are actually not derived from plants pollinated by insects. Mostly they are grains and cereals, corn, rice, wheat, and the like. And they do fine without animal pollinators. But then how will we do without our fruits, nuts, and vegetables? That it would take a even more environmental insult than has ever been inflicted, I think, to wipe out all honeybees. As I mentioned, they are cosmopolitan, global in distribution. In fact, in 2005, when the almond industry wasn't convinced it could get enough honeybees from American apiculture, honeybees were imported from Australia. So there are bees around the world. There are 20 different races. We have only just taken a tiny, thin sliver of honeybee diversity. So I think there is the genetic capacity to deal with some of these challenges. Now, that said, there will be almost certainly, because of habitat alteration and urbanization and industrialized agriculture, a diminution of natural areas that can sustain wild pollinators. We don't even know who they are, all of them, and we are likely to lose certain pollinators, and the consequences for whatever plants they pollinate may well be dire. There are some examples where the extinction of a pollinator has led to the near extinction of plants that depend on that pollinator. In Hawaii, for example, there are some lobelioid plants that depend on a type of hawk moth, a sphingid moth, that is their unique and exclusive pollinator. And now the only way this hawk moth went extinct in some of the islands, and the only way to get these plants to get pollinated is botanists scale basically sheer cliff walls that can't pollinate them.
Oh, well, you've been a wealth of information. Thank you so much.
Oh.
And I'm wondering, can you direct people to where they can go to get more information?
Oh, well, Pollinator Partnership would be a good place to find out, you know, productive ways that
okay.
you can self-help.
Pollinator Partnership.
Uh-huh. And if you're interested in buying local honey, I've actually written a book called Honey, I'm Homemade. It's Sweet Treats from the Beehive. And all of the proceeds go to our Pollinatarium, which is the first freestanding science center devoted to raising pollinator awareness right here at the University of Illinois campus. You can get it on Amazon.
Oh, great.
And for a cookbook, it's got a lot of information about honeybees, because I'm not a cook. I'm an entomologist. So.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for the call. I really appreciate it.
Professor Mae Barenbaum, an American entomologist. She's at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana. Well, that was fascinating, wasn't it? Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this program, and thanks for all of your calls and emails. Appreciate them. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and we'll return and have a fascinating hour with Jonathan Alter, who has a new book, The Center Holds, Obama and His Enemies. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.